Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr. And today we have special guest, Dr. Guillermo Escalante. And we got some interesting stuff. We're going to talk about some anabolic steroids, maybe some creatine, some protons, some sterons.
electrons,
all this different stuff.
Heavy on the electrons.
Dr. Escalante, could you just give us a brief, quick little snippet background? Who the heck are you?
Yeah, absolutely. And first and foremost, thanks so much for inviting me and having me on here. I'm excited to be part of your podcast. But a little bit about me. So I'm currently the assistant dean and a professor of kinesiology at California State University, San Bernardino. I'm also a fellow of the International Society of Sports Nutrition, and I'm an associate editor for the Journal of the International Society of Sports Nutrition. So that's my background. In brief, I do everything kind of related to research and related to sports medicine, sports epidemiology, injury prevention, strength and conditioning, performance enhancement, and then the nutrition supplementation, and specifically recently very much on the bodybuilding and extreme bodybuilding practices done by bodybuilders, since I'm a bodybuilder myself.
Yeah. Okay. How long have you been doing bodybuilding, specifically like competition type bodybuilding?
Yeah, so I'm 46. Let's see, 22 years. 22 wow. years I've been competing, and I've competed almost every year with a few years on and off as I was finishing my doctorate and whatnot. But pretty much every year with a couple of 1 year gaps in between there.
Okay, you played sports back in the day?
I did. I was in high school. I played football and I ran track and field, and then in college I did the same for a little stint.
Oh,
and then when I finished my collegiate career, that's when I went into bodybuilding. I was looking for an outlet mm-hmm. to continue to be competitive, since obviously
yeah.
can't really compete in a lot of these organized sports anymore. So then that's when a friend led me into bodybuilding, and I kind of got hooked on it after I did my first show.
That's so kind of a little bit. We dabbled a little bit in that for the same reason. Yeah.
Yeah. How tall are you?
I'm a short guy. So actually Carl's tall compared to me.
I don't remember that being the case. So we were about the same, I felt like, but
yeah, I'm about five. I like to say I'm 5'5" with shoes, 5'6" with shoes on.
Yeah. I always say I'm 5'6" on a good day or after like a pull-up day, and 5'5½" on squat days. Well, I can't squat anymore because of my bad hips, but anyways, you get the idea.
How much do you weigh?
I weigh about 195.
Okay. So you're pretty jacked.
He's a big dude.
All right. I think according to the BMI, I think you have obesity.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. My BMI is something like 32 or something like
wow.
that.
So,
yeah.
Which is why. So just to give you a little background on how we met. So he represented the National Society of Sports Nutrition at a consensus conference that I chaired with the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, focused on obesity stigma and how that sort of correlates with, you know, diagnosis classification. And so it was very fitting that he was the representative because of being very muscular, healthy, and with low body fat, because part of what we discussed was the fact that the disease of obesity is really a disease of adiposity, and BMI is just a way to screen or population-based stuff and not a personal diagnosis. So that's actually that was just kind of a nice little thing, because I didn't know that when you were chosen as the representative. So anyway,
interesting.
That worked out well. Yeah.
So yeah, the reason we wanted Dr. Escalante, and well, there's a few reasons, but you recently published a study. Is that right?
Recently I had a couple of recent pubs in the last month or so. The first one that came out was actually on an autopsy reports of dead bodybuilders that have basically died before the age of 50, specifically from cardiovascular disease. And the way this came about was there was over the last decade. I mean, there's always been deaths in bodybuilding, but specifically in the last few years, we've seen Sean Roden, we've seen George Peterson. We saw Dallas McCarver. We saw John Meadows. So we see this conglomerate of pretty high level bodybuilders that were young men, and they passed away. And so that really piqued my interest into, you know, hey, what's going on? Why is this happening? And of course, you know, when you dive into the anabolic steroid literature and performance enhancement drug literature, you see a lot of associations with cardiomyopathy and left ventricular hypertrophy. But obviously, it's very hard to draw cause and effect with all of that. So, you know, all I try to do is just kind of put another piece of the puzzle together and, mm-hmm. and try to kind of link these and try to study this a little bit further. Yeah. So what ended up happening is I got together with one of my colleagues who's also a physician, Dr. Daniel Bortney. He's also a bodybuilder. And then our other colleague who's an attorney, actually, but he's also a fellow of the International Society of Sports Nutrition, works with a lot of bodybuilders, represented the legal aspect. And then I got a couple of one of my student assistants to kind of help us along with the process. And what we talked about doing was, hey, let's look at who has died in bodybuilding in general over the last like 12 years. Let's just kind of do an analysis. So we actually did a very simple Google search and kind of saw, hey, who's died? And we slowly kind of started filtering. What we really kind of wanted to focus on was who has reportedly died of specifically cardiovascular disease, because that was our main topic. And we started filtering down more and more. And then what we really wanted to get to was, let's look at the autopsy reports that are available from these individuals. So at the end of the day, you know, we had a whole list of, I don't know, 40 plus bodybuilders that have died before the age of 50. Wow. For different reasons. And then of cardiovascular disease, we're able to narrow it down a little bit further. By the time we were able to weed out, because there were some people that died, for example, Luke Sandow is from the UK. He was a high-level competitor, died at the age of 30, reportedly of cardiovascular-related event. Obviously, because he was in the UK, you can't get that autopsy report, or at least not easy to get. So we focus on the ones that we could get here in the United States, and we were able to narrow it down to actually six bodybuilders who had died of cardiovascular disease before the age of 50, between the years of 2010 to 2022. And we did this search in February of 2022, so it was actually very early in 2022. Because since then, actually, there's been a couple of other deaths that occurred in the bodybuilding space. And then we were able to read through the autopsy reports and just started kind of looking at some specific things. There were a lot of things looking at liver and kidneys, but we focused on the heart. And we looked at what was in the autopsy report in relation to the heart. And gosh, the average age of these bodybuilders was about 36, 37 years old that had died. A lot of them were highly competitive, actually professional bodybuilders, IFBB professional bodybuilders. And except one, I think Rich Piana was one who was not one, but
well-known.
Yeah, well-known guy. And we actually were able to kind of get some specifics out of there. One of the main things that we saw was how big was the heart? So just heart enlargement overall. Yeah. And
you have a graph in there that I see, right? A nice little graph that shows kind of a nice comparison anyways, right?
Exactly. And we actually did it to the reference man. So we wanted to see, it's like, hey, for the, compared to the average guy, you know, what is their average weight of their heart compared to these bodybuilders? And we actually see that it's about 74% heavier than the average man who is not on anabolic steroids, performance enhancement drugs. Mm-hmm. Now, we have to take that with a grain of salt, because obviously we do know that the heart does enlarge even in unenhanced lifters. Mm-hmm. But it was hard to kind of get that data into, like, hey, what is the average size of the heart for an unenhanced lifter?
Kind of across the board. Here's a question, I guess, just because, you know, docs who lift, we've never used anabolic steroids or any other hormones or any enhancement to that degree, other than creatine, which we'll talk about later, I guess. How do you know, for sure that these guys were doing that? I mean, how did you figure that out?
Oh, absolutely. So a couple of things. Well, in the autopsy reports, there were often police reports as well. So you actually see the inventory that they found in their possession, and you see different anabolic compounds, you know, such testosterone derivatives, trenbolone, etc. So you see large quantities of these were found, you know, in their apartments or their houses. In some of them, they actually did some toxicology reports. So they actually ran some drug tests on these individuals. Oh. And then they actually say, it's like, okay, yeah, this compound was found, this compound was found, which actually led us to another down. We kind of put a little side note in there that we actually found a paper looking at some of the limitations in doctors who do these autopsy reports or the coroners, because there's actually not a good way. Some of them are just not very thorough. And really to, if you actually see, for example, so if you're a coroner and you see a young man that's 35 who looks relatively healthy, who died of a cardiac condition, kind of dig a little further and kind of put the pieces of the puzzle together, and you probably see enlarged muscularity. So for example, one of the ways that we kind of could confirm indirectly was looking at fat free mass index. And we know that fat free mass index for some of these individuals, you know, is well over 29, 30. And it's very hard to get above 25 a fat free mass index naturally. There are some outliers that can maybe get fat free mass index as of 26, 27. But there were two of those bodybuilders who actually died at contest shape. So we did an assumption that, hey, let's say these bodybuilders were 5% body fat based on the body weight when they were, that they were found, you know, what is their fat free mass index? And you see their fat free mass index was in their high 20s. So that's very, very unlikely that any person, regardless of how genetically gifted you are, would have a fat free mass index of 28, 29. Without use of performance enhancement drugs.
Could you explain what the fat free mass index for those who are listening?
We've done this in the past because, you know, growing up, people have falsely suggested I must have been on anabolic steroids since I was like 10 years old, even when I was pre-pubertal. But I think, Spencer, do you remember what when we calculated? When I was like, when I was in my 20s.
Borderline. It was always borderline.
I was in
borderline.
My 20s, 20, you know,
20, 25. I don't know. You're right
like
around
that,
25,
you know,
26.
I'm 5'6". You know, I was a pretty lean 175 when I was in my late 20s, you know, pretty, you know, I've, you know, I'm aging, so I'm not as big anymore, I guess, but, you know, in that realm. So I don't know what that calculates to.
Yeah, absolutely. So like the fat free mass index is it's very similar to the body mass index calculation, instead of taking that full body weight, you actually take the lean body mass. So you have to know the person's body fat percentage. So to give a quick example, let's say you're 200 pounds, we'll do the math easy, and you're 10% body fat. That means that your lean body mass is 180 pounds. And then you divide it by your height. Of course, you have to convert it into meters and kilograms. But you basically do the same formula that you do for BMI. But
we don't do that in America.
Yes. That's right. That's right. But you get the lean body weight on top. That's your numerator, the top number, and then in kilograms, and then you divide it by your height in meters squared, then you get your fat free mass index. So instead of putting your total body weight, you just put your lean body mass on top.
All right, let's calculate Casey's. He's 5 foot nothing. I'm just kidding. He's 5 foot. let's just say 5'5", and you, how much do you weigh right now?
Right now, 165.
165. He's atrophying, and your body fat, your body fat percentage, let's just say 10%.
Yeah, these days.
This says you have a fat free mass of 24.76. You're right. Yeah.
And so it had to be a little higher, but you know, in my 20s, of course. Of course, you're at your peak, you know.
Yeah.
My natural testosterone levels were probably pretty good. Back then, you know, maybe not quite puberty, but you know, pretty good, a little better
probably
than what they are now.
Mine's more like 23.
So I mean, and you said you start getting up into 27, 28, 29, and it's like, that's because certainly I would think, based on everything we've ever heard, that you know, we push the natural, you know, I think limitations, which
we were wrestling.
Nice to hear, I guess. You know, but a lot of wrestlers, football players, like you know.
Yeah, I mean, I know some dudes
just,
that.
There are just some just absolutely stacked guys that have to have these these pretty push, and you know, and they're not, I, you know, I don't think they are. I mean, especially when they're getting tested in college all the time.
So some of these guys didn't even seem like they lift. They didn't even care about lifting weights. They just came in just jacked, and they weren't, they didn't really care about it. It was weird.
But they're the cream of the crop. I mean, the genetic cream of the crop in Division I sports. Yeah. But then everyone, you know, all the lay people out there, you guys are all on everything.
Well,
because they feel like they can't.
Well, to their credit, there are a lot of people that are just taking it and they're on Instagram and
that's true. We'll circle back to which
tilapia
we'll
to and their
why you did this.
I like that actual discussion there, because it's very important, I think, for the general public to understand is that, you know, some of these people, even the Mr. Olympias of the world, you know, mm-hmm. that are up there, you know, when they're 16, a lot of them are already very naturally lifted. I mean, they're naturally bench pressing 350 for reps at 16 years old without taking anything.
Yeah. They've already kind of, there's a little bit of a selection bias, right? So you got the genetic guys who are into lifting, maybe like us, you know, the us as a collective us. And then suddenly they go that extra mile for professional bodybuilding. And, I would say, unfortunately, that's part of their game is this stuff. And, you know, to reference back to one of our other talks on hypogonadism and testosterone and these clinics out there that do, they claim it's TRT, but they're just selling guys what essentially I would call is steroids. You know, this talk today is really, you know, for most people, hey, we would say don't do that unless you need replacement therapy. So we went on a tangent there, but.
No, I think to the young kids, I think this is really important because I see a lot of young men in their, 20, 22, 24 who have mm-hmm. perfectly normal testosterone level. And they often kind of justify it's like, oh, well, I'm just on TRT. I'm like, well, if you're 22 years old, you don't need TRT. There's called testosterone replacement. If your testosterone levels are, 800, 1,000, like you don't need a replacement. You're already doing fine.
Right. And then, of course, what I say, and I literally just had this conversation because Spencer saw, I happened to be on TikTok trying to post something, and I saw some guy representing some, online male MD something or other. And he was bragging about how he's on, and he's only 38, by the way, he was on testosterone and growth hormone and yada, everything, right? And he's like, yeah, so, you don't want to go to your doctor who weighs 300 pounds and smokes and drinks alcohol. And so I was like, well, one, that's pretty divisive because most doctors aren't going to do that. Most doctors do work out. They might not be as historically into it as we are. So sure, I get that. And then he was like, but look at me. And so anyways, I did a little post on it saying it's not TRT if you don't have a deficiency that otherwise can't have the underlying root cause treated either. So as an endocrinologist, we get referred people who have hypothalamic pituitary disorders that they may not be able to get it fixed. You know what I mean? Right. You have primary hypogonadism. Your testicles fail. There's not much you can do about that. So then you need true replacement therapy. Sometimes we're able to fix the underlying root cause. And a lot of it is obesity, sleep apnea, and stuff like that, by the way, for most of the people out there. So anyways,
I see it, unfortunately. Soapbox. And then they get stuck on it and I have to get them off and I have to sometimes do Clomid, HCG and all these different things.
Yeah. And sometimes these places, not to get hammer these other places too much because we're trying to talk about your study, but they might get someone who really does have hypogonadism and then they just put them on testosterone, but they forgot to evaluate the underlying cause. And next thing you know, they have a pituitary tumor that infarcts or they have some other bad disease that should have been seeing a doctor like me, and they have Cushing's or acromegaly or prolactinoma. And anyways, so for doctors out there, clinicians, please evaluate appropriately for hypogonadism and for patients, don't just go out and look for places that sell TRT, which is ultimately potentially having adverse effects that you're going to then tell us more about. Sorry.
Yeah.
Go on a tangent.
Tell us more. Give us more.
No, absolutely. Well, so the other thing that we saw, there was actually some atherosclerosis that you found in a lot of these. So you saw a lot of these in the underlying conditions. You see left ventricular hypertrophy. That's another common thread that we found among some of these bodybuilders. The list kind of goes on and on in terms of the cause of death. Very common is cardiomyopathy, left ventricular hypertrophy, et cetera. So you see these kind of going on and on each other. And it's a very common thread. So we actually put a table in that study kind of looking at what were some of the specific comments in terms of specifically related to the heart that were written by the coroners in all of these bodybuilders. And then that thread, you see a lot of common things over and over again. And again, you always have to think, okay, well, is there a genetic predisposition to some of these? And I say, well, yeah, perhaps there is. You know, maybe you have a high level of lipoprotein A, which there's a genetic predisposition to that. Okay, great. But now there's a lot of people that have this genetic predisposition, but they're not dying at 37 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So you're just basically accelerating the process over time. So instead of, you know, having issues when you're in your late 50s, late 60s, 70s, now you're having it 20 or 30 years younger.
It would. Did they mention anything about their history of blood pressure and anything like that? So for anybody listening, there's multiple risk factors. We've talked about this before for cardiovascular disease. There's obviously age, as you just mentioned. You see these things a little bit older, but smoking, yes, sure. These people, I assume, weren't smoking. Blood pressure, lipids, insulin resistance, all these different types of things can be risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So did they have anything about their lipids or their blood pressure or just anything like that?
On one particular case, they did. He had a history of dyslipidemia. He had a history of hypertension. He had a history of breathing disorders. He had a chronic cough for a long time. Hmm. So you actually see some of that in one of the reports. And I think to your point, that's actually one of the biggest issues with some of these bodybuilders. I like to say, you know, you need to quote unquote look under the hood on a regular basis. So, you know, if you decide to go down this road and you know, this is your, you know, the way you make your living and you're going to compete at the top level, you know, the very least you can do is, you know, work with a healthcare provider that can actually do regular blood work, you know, check your blood lipids, check your blood pressure, and then, you know, strategize into ways in which you can manage some of these things. Because very typically when you see especially high dosages of anabolic steroid use over a prolonged period of time, you're going to see the HDL levels drop down to the teens or even single digits. I've seen it with some blood work. You see the LDLs typically rise. When we actually were testing individuals that were coming in, these are just amateur bodybuilders in their blood pressure. I mean, I had one individual come in and his blood pressure was something like 190 over 110, 28 years old. You know, then we actually see the compounds that he's taking. And I'm like, have you gone to see your doctor? You know, I'm just a researcher. I said, but have you gone to see your doctor? And have you talked to them about your hypertension? Because like, you know, this is not borderline hypertensive here. I mean, and you're 28 years old, and how long have you had this high blood pressure? Did you even know you had it? Sometimes they're utilizing growth hormone on top of this, and high levels of growth hormone over a long period of time can also cause insulin resistance, which can also contribute to some of these other things. So I think there's a lot to unwrap there. And my biggest advice to bodybuilders that are enhanced is, you know, to use a safer model. So in other words, less is more. For one, you don't need to use these. It's still going to be super physiological, but not stupid for super physiological. Yeah. And number two, if you are doing that, go to your doctor and go to your doctor when you're on cycle, not just when you're off cycle. Because some bodybuilders will say, oh, I'm on for 9 months and I'm off for three. And they go get their blood work, you know, 6 weeks into their off cycle. So they're looking at a snippet of their quote unquote health during the time that they're off, but they're really on 9 months out of the year. So what's actually going on when you're actually full blasting stuff, if that's what you're choosing to do. So you are actually aware of what's really going on under the hood.
Yeah. Here's a question.
I was going to say, I have a large handful of these patients who are, you know, competitive professional bodybuilders, and we monitor their blood pressure. Many of them are on ACE inhibitors. Sometimes I have to add on, a thiazide diuretic. It's a type of diuretic to keep their blood pressure low. The issue is, though, when they start going to competition, their electrolytes, I've seen some really
That's
scary things that I was like, oh my God, I like you know, I don't know how you're even alive. It can be very scary when you're doing that. But
so then I'm going to throw you the question then, Spencer. So you're primary care doctor. So you got these people seeing you. Obviously, I'm the specialist endocrinologist. You know, and you're talking about making sure these guys are talking to their doctors. I mean, the first thing I would say is, and we're probably good ones to discuss it with, because at least we're into fitness. We know what's out there. We're not just going to be like, oh my God, that's horrible. Stop it. You know, and we do the same thing with smoking or any other drugs, by the way. You know, we need to not shame people because that's not going to help. But I would still strongly discuss with them, hey, I care about your health. I would suggest you not do this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because one of the ironic things that I've always felt about this, and this is, we've been into this since we were little kids. You know, my dad was a science teacher, an athlete, a coach. And so we were real nerdy into the health benefits of sports and working out. And we still are. That's this whole thing, right? That's what we do. And so it makes me a little sad that we talk so much about how important lifting weights is and other forms of exercise. It is the best medicine for everyone. And then for these guys who, they are doing it, they should be the epitome of health. But then they go to the extreme and it's not good for them anymore. And
it's a quest for more muscle. They want more muscle.
Right. Well, I understand
but
that.
So
I want everyone to work out.
I have the conversation with the patient. What they'll say is that, like, you know, I basically say, like, look, it's my duty to tell you, like, hey, I'm going to help keep you as healthy as possible. So my recommendation would be to not take super physiological testosterone derivatives. I mean, I suppose any testosterone derivative is not physiological since we don't make it in the body, but whatever, it doesn't matter. But high doses of both testosterone and other testosterone derivatives, along with growth hormone, exogenous.
By the way, they use insulin too.
Yeah, insulin. Like, that's what I was just going to say.
Insulin. That scares me as an endocrinologist, but that actually, they do it really well.
They know what they're doing.
You know, I guess. That's
so luckily, I have very smart, you know, patients, and I, you know, monitor them closely. We monitor their blood pressure. The blood pressure is stark normal. Their lipids, HDL is generally in the tank. However, you know, you want to look at ApoB, apolipoprotein B. It's the protein that is surrounded by the particles that can get into your arteries. And because these testosterone derivatives can also drive that up through various mechanisms.
Yeah. Well, I see in your paper that the one guy that you're talking about had the dyslipidemia. It said it had an elevated LDL also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you see that. So, but, you know, a lot of these things can be mitigated through diet. So if they're eating, you know, very low saturated fat, high fiber, I've seen it mitigated. Their HDL is in the tank, but their ApoB is actually, you know, sometimes it's better than mine. And I'm like, okay, well, geez. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, you add a statin or ezetimibe or something else like that to help them out. Maybe their supplement was psyllium husk.
But now, that's not going to help this.
So my question is,
you know, we just got through Christmas.
Yeah.
You know how the Grinch, his heart grew three times the size that day.
This is the question though. Right. So the question is, you have all these risk factors optimized. Is there a separate component, an actual intrinsic component of these anabolics, obviously growth hormone, that go beyond the risk factors? I think there probably is, if I had to guess. So let's say their blood pressure is like better than mine. It's, you know, like 108 over 70. Their ApoB is like 60, you know, very, very good. You know, their glucose is 80, their A1C is 5 or whatever, something like that. Insulin levels are nice and low, other than when they inject their insulin. Are these people likely? I think they're probably still at a risk for maybe not as much of the atherosclerosis, but the cardiomegaly part, the part where the heart enlarges. So there's different types of different reasons why you would die from this. It's not just the atherosclerosis. People would die of sudden cardiac death from cardiomegaly, the electricity that flows through the heart.
And that's the common theme of your paper is this. I mean, when you look at that graph, the six guys that died, they're just the weight it was what your graph is weight, right? Or its mass,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And they were all significantly bigger than the reference size.
So I'm just wondering, do we need to do preventive echocardiograms? I don't even know what that would. I would be like, hey, your heart's freaking huge. We need to like take it down a notch. I also monitor hematocrit, by the way.
Well, yeah. I was going to ask if there was anything about hematocrit because I'm not sure I saw that in there. But
yeah, absolutely. Well, and hematocrit was obviously in that paper there isn't, but that's something that I think, you know, as you're talking about, is we should be looking at is what are hematocrit levels. And because obviously it's going to increase red blood cell production. And if that's going unmanaged, then that could potentially lead to other effects. And specifically, you talked about diuretics, and that's enough. That I think that to me, before we even look at anabolic steroids, the first flag of danger of immediate potential acute death in bodybuilding is diuretic abuse and diuretic use, specifically before a show, because there's this terminology in bodybuilding of he looks watery or she looks watery, but most of the time it's really not water. It's really body fat. They really need an extra month or two of dieting to get a little leaner. And lo and behold, if they were to be 8 pounds with less body fat, all of a sudden you see striations in the glutes and you're not quote unquote holding water because you're leaner. But the mentality is some of these coaches that are, coaching these individuals, they come in, instead of telling the individual, we need another 2 months before you're really stage ready, they say, let me give you this diuretic. And they're not physicians like you guys. They're not trained in the pharmacology of this stuff. And some are smarter than others. Some maybe do know a little bit, but they're prescribing dosages for these things, you know, and sometimes they're combining loop diuretics with other diuretics with, you know, maybe a potassium sparing diuretic. They maybe don't understand that, hey, these are cumulative effects. You know, the half-life is going to be longer. So maybe one dose can actually do the trick and you don't need a dose at 6 and at 9 and at 12 and at 6, you know, because it's cumulative. And before you know it, it's kind of like what Spencer said is now you have this individual where electrolytes are way down. I actually worked as an athletic trainer covering the medical side of things of these bodybuilding events. And that was the number one thing that I saw was dehydration. If, you know, where I would actually... I would see low blood pressure, high heart rates. I would see no sweating. I would see ringing in the ears. I would see dizziness. I would see disorientation. I would see weakness. I would see muscle cramping. And then when you put all the things together, you're actually seeing, oh yeah, I haven't had water in or minimal water in the last 48 to 72 hours. I also took this high dosage of this diuretic. I've been on that since Tuesday. Yeah. And then you're wondering like, how are you even standing? You know, how are you literally standing?
Yeah.
And a lot of them, we could actually work with backstage and, you know, rehydrate them, give them some Pedialyte, get some fluids in them, get their electrolytes up. And they would obviously feel better within a matter of, you know, 30 minutes or so. Sometimes, and actually, one of the individuals that I actually had to send him to the hospital. I said, you can't compete. You got to go off stage. I said, we don't need to call the ambulance, but you need to go to the ER now. And sure enough, they admitted him. And when they ran the blood work, he actually, I was responding with him, how are you doing? And he texted me a couple of days later. He said, if I had not gone to the ER, he says, I don't think I would be talking to you today. Because that's how bad his blood work looked.
Yeah. Wow. Well, and as wrestlers, of course, Spencer never cut a pound in his life.
Not a damn pound.
The rest of us, you know, always had to cut weight to make weight. And, that's pushing it too. And I tell all the kids, you know, get as big and muscular and lean as you can. And then, you know, just water weight cut within reason. You know, it's easy to lose a few pounds in practice and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, you know, we used to cut a fair amount, and the guys before me, the era before me, they cut even more. I don't know. Hopefully nobody's doing diuretics, but I know some guys probably do. And I had one teammate once, I'm not going to name any names, before, I think it was Midland, Spencer, one of my teammates, he had an acute kidney injury.
Wow.
And that was before I knew what that was, other than it's kidneys. And I was like, that was, you know, now it makes sense to me, but I was like, oh my God. So
that's a whole other extreme. Yeah, if you're dropping 2-3% of your body weight, you know, your body can handle that. But now if you're dropping 6-10% of your body weight, you know, you're playing with fire at that point in time.
Yeah.
And that's not uncommon for people to lose 10% of your body weight in a 24 to 36 hour period.
I got stories.
Gosh. Jeez. So I think the gist of it is there's multiple ways you can die from heart issues. I'm not convinced that this is all from ischemic, you know, atherosclerosis that I like to talk about. I think
a lot of it's the cardiomegaly and the cardiomyopathy.
You can absolutely advance, like really accelerate the atherosclerosis part due to the dyslipidemia and likely the blood pressure. But I think there's probably a sudden cardiac death from these electrolyte changes and the cardiomegaly. And for those listening, like if you don't understand, it's basically your, you know, your ventricles are the bottom strong part of your heart. They go flip, thump and pushing blood through your body. It gets so big and there's something that can happen, the fibrillation of your ventricles, not just your atrium. And basically just doesn't push.
The electrical conductions not working right. They're not.
Yeah. And then they just kind of contracting, they can flutter, fibrillate, whatever. Yeah. And now you're not getting blood to the rest of your
body. It's just like
body.
The Grinch.
Yeah. Well, and you see the ejection fraction of some of these bodybuilders, that they've actually, there's some literature on that. And it's often, 50% or less in some of them. This is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. That reminds me, when I was a resident, Spencer, at Portsmouth Naval Hospital, I was an internal medicine resident when I was on admitting, there was a guy, a very nice kid. He was a Marine and he was into bodybuilding and he was obviously, I don't know what he was using, but he was, and he came in not infrequently for heart failure exacerbations. And he was in his 20s for sure, a young, otherwise healthy guy. And I remember the cardiologists actually came to me. I was an internal medicine resident and they just knew that I was a meathead and maybe had some interest in it. And so we did some, literature review and stuff and tried to talk to the guy. I tried to talk to him, meathead to meathead a little bit. And I don't know, if he's okay. I have no idea right now because I it's been a while, but that happened. And that definitely was a story that I tried to pass on to people to warn of the potential dangers. And I mean, in his 20s, heart failure exacerbations that we normally see in people who've had heart attacks or whatever later on in life where their heart doesn't work anymore. So.
Gosh. Yeah. And combining some of these things is where the issues with regards to the red blood cell count, because the testosterone and the derivatives are going to increase. You're going to have potentially some absolute increased red blood cells. So you're going to have erythrocytosis at that point in time. Mm-hmm. But then now you add these electrolytes, no water, water cutting, and then now you're going to have relative erythrocytosis on top of your absolute erythrocytosis. And that blood is like, as thick as can be. And now you see some of these acute deaths.
So. Yeah. Here's a question then for you too. So in just, sort of general medicine, when we have someone on who has hypogonadism and we have them on testosterone replacement therapy, one of the things we always rule out first that can cause hypogonadism is sleep apnea. So untreated sleep apnea itself can increase, your erythrocytes, hemoglobin, hematocrit. And so, that's one of the things we talk about when guys are on actual TRT, et cetera. So, we monitor red blood cells, right? That is one of the basic things we monitor. And then we talk about sleep apnea. Are some of these guys also to the point where
they all have sleep apnea?
Their
necks are huge.
Their fat-free mass index, think about us and then enhanced and, despite being muscle and thinking
it doesn't matter.
A good thing, it's bad for sleep apnea. So then is that a problem and contributing to that too?
I would say that's definitely a contributing factor, as a hypothesis, because, you see the mass of some of these guys. I mean, they have a hard time walking up the stairs, If you're 5'8" and you're walking, the heaviest I've ever been when I was bulking up was 230 pounds. I was chubby at 230, but let me tell you, putting on my shoes, I had to hold my breath because it was very difficult. And when I slept at night, I did not sleep well. And if I had a sleep study at that point in time, I am sure I would have had, it would have been diagnosed, it would not surprise me if these larger bodybuilders, or eating high quantities of food, eating 6,000-8,000 calories a day on a regular basis, it's not this, you just have these different pathways, which are all leading to Disaster.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Spencer, when you were a heavyweight,
I definitely
wrestling heavyweight in D1, and you weren't taking any steroids or anything, but no, you were force feeding yourself to be big.
Like,
you were
like, so 260, yeah, I've talked about this, but I got up to 267 after, like, was after a meal, though. Like, I mean, I was bloated. That was super bloated, but like, I had to eat full pizzas. My natural body, like, I'm actually a naturally thinner guy, so I had to like force myself to be a heavyweight. And I, you know, people listening, like, oh, nice, you lose weight so easily. It's like, I'm sorry, I'm genetically thinner.
We talked about that last time, you know,
a thinner person, but
genetics play a big role.
My neck was huge. I definitely had sleep apnea. There's no way I did not.
It was a strong neck, but.
Strong neck, but it was huge, and it doesn't matter. It's mostly, you know, muscle. I mean, you could see my abs, but I wasn't like one of these bodybuilders, you know, who's like, gosh, blurry. Okay, they're blurry.
You have that blurred four pack. I know what you're talking about.
I had a blurred four pack. It was never like Casey had. He had abs in utero. So come on,
this comes up every podcast.
He came out of the womb. He had abs. He had a dumbbell in his hand. I don't know how he got a dumbbell.
I don't know, but you got to. We have a picture of Trey with a dumbbell that you got him as a baby. So we'll see what he ends up.
But
doing.
Yeah, sleep apnea is a big. Most of my patients that are competitive bodybuilders, like, you know, the big bodybuilder, not just like the, you know, natural bodybuilder, but like big, just jacked dudes. They all have CPAPs and make sure that they're calibrated correctly and everything. Because that would be another reason their heart would enlarge, especially if it's not treated. So
absolutely.
That's good. What else? Anything else before we kind of wind down here? Anything else from this autopsy report?
I think we got the meat and potatoes of everything there. I mean, the reality is you know, we did end kind of saying, it's like, you know, again, once again, association is not causation, but we need to look further into. I always say, if there's a smoking gun, we should look further into some of these things and try to investigate them further. And unfortunately, you know, it's very hard to do and conduct randomized control trials with this stuff, because no IRB is going to allow you to do super physiological doses of these things and see what happens. So, and I mean, even the literature on testosterone use, I mean, the highest amount that I've read is maybe 600 milligrams or so, 800 milligrams, which is a high dose, but compared to what some of these bodybuilders are doing, I mean, 1 gram is on the low side. It's not uncommon.
It's amazing.
Wait, hold on. First, for everyone out there, because we'll clarify this, because this is amazing if I'm getting what you're putting down.
Yeah.
You're talking about 600, 800 milligrams of testosterone per what?
Per week?
Yeah.
So for the people out there, to be clear, my patients who we're doing replacement therapy with, who have true hypogonadism, it's in the range of 75 to 1, whatever, you know, in the hundreds per week. You know, and then we have different formulations. You know, we use the gels and the patches and the shots and the whatever. But just so people have a context of how much more some of these guys are using.
Yeah, so you're saying 600 to 800 in the studies that we have. And then these guys are at the lowest dose, a gram.
A gram a week.
And then on top of that, though,
and that's
they're doing trenbolone sandwiches.
and growth hormone. And by the way, when we talk about, like, say, growth hormone, we have really good data on people who have acromegaly, which is the pituitary tumor that makes too much growth hormone. And it is a really bad disease for people, including cardiomegaly, heart enlargement, and all these other things, sleep apnea, knee issues, cancers and stuff like that. So, you know, I know we're talking a lot about anabolic steroids, but, you know, the growth hormone abuse,
is a big concern.
I mean, yeah, no, you know, you get people, endocrinologists, hormone docs like me, makes me anxious thinking about people doing that stuff.
I've heard of individuals doing upwards of, you know, 5-6 milligrams a day of growth hormone. You know,
wow. What's a replacement dose?
It's a lot lower than that. So, we're talking like less than one usually, okay, like for adults, depending, you know, and we use IGF-1 levels to, you know, get them into normal range. You know, kids, like little kids, and I'm not a pediatrician, but like kid dosing is much higher, but it's still not that high that you just said. It's more like, you know, like in the ones, twos, you know, because obviously they have really high growth hormone levels normally. So their replacement therapy is much higher.
So these guys are using 5-6. Wow.
Yeah, that's.
That's the other thing. I mean, the dosages, you know, that, and of course, now what we see is bodybuilders in the 80s and 90s were retiring, you know, in their 30s or maybe late 20s, maybe into their mid 30s, maybe late 30s, you'd see a few, with a few exceptions, of course, like Albert Beckles competed in his 60s and won a pro show, but he's kind of an anomaly, right? But now what we are seeing is, I mean, people like myself, right? I mean, I've been competing for, you know, 20 plus years and you're having competitors that are taking, you know, super physiological doses, extreme super physiological doses, not for 5 or 10 years, but for 20 or 30 years. And again, it's just that dose response relationship and then exposure over time, and of course there are those individuals, like anything else, genetics play a big part, where there are individuals who with 400 milligrams a week will get super jacked because they just, they're the people that, you know, that walk into the weight room and they don't even need to lift. Like they just transform right there.
Yeah.
And then you have other individuals, maybe a small dosage gives them a lot of side effects, and other individuals can handle a lot more and gives them little side effects. So there's so much inter-individual variability with all of that, which we just don't know. And we have a lot to study. So all we're left with as scientists is kind of where I'm at now, is let's look at what's being done on the field and let's bring those individuals in if they can volunteer to study, and let's see what's going on under the hood with these people that are under super physiological dosages and see what's going on with them compared to people that are lifting that are not using that
stuff. We probably need to do more of that, find a way to make it, you know, not without shaming people. Again,
it's been taboo. It's like,
right.
Again,
I recommend against it, but we do need to learn about it. Just like we need to learn about cannabis, just like we need to learn about alcohol, smoking, anything that people like.
Because people
to
are
do.
Going to do it. I appreciate the people that are honest about it and talk about their journey and how they're trying to make it at least healthful. I appreciate those people. I will say, you know, there was a picture of me and my brother. And someone was like, you guys take steroids, whatever. And I was like, we've never taken steroids. He's like, I wasn't talking about you. You're clearly natural. I'm like, I was like, you son of a.
He's talking about me. But of course, it's always, you know, the other thing is, you know, when you talk about that stuff, we go off on tangent for this all the time. But like, you know, we happen to be pretty lean at the time. We've always been pretty muscular. And we're out in the sun. We're flexing. And we were working out. You know, I mean, so. Yeah, it's not like we look like that all the time. It just happened to be a nice setting of whatever. And it's,
now, Casey looks like that all the time.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm getting old a little bit. But yeah, no, I mean, that's just, you're right. Genetics, it plays a role. And I've been working out since I was a little kid. And we'll have a whole episode on that, too, once we figure out what we want to say. So,
well, thanks so much, Dr. Escalante. We're going to have you on. We're going to probably talk. We have all sorts of other topics that we'd love to have you on. Well,
Do we have time today to do a second episode,
no,
or do you got to get going to your meeting?
We don't. Okay.
We'll do the creatine one. Talk about, you know, a really safe, but the one supplement that has some efficacy is creatine. So yeah, we could do that one.
We should do a whole thing on creatine. It doesn't have to be that long. Cool.
No, absolutely. That'll be fun. And we could discuss that. That's creatine's a good topic.
Very good. Thank you so much for coming on. We'll chat soon.
Hold on. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Stand by.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.
Cool.